Sarah, you ready?
All right, it is 10 a.m., so I will call us to order on our regularly scheduled Board of Supervisors meeting for this Tuesday, April 9th, 2013. I welcome everybody and ask that you please join the board in honoring America with the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Well, thank you and good morning. I'd like to tell you that we were having weather like we had yesterday, but today's a good day to be inside. First item on our agenda is public comment number one. This is a comment period for members of the public to address topics on today's agenda. Do we have anybody wishing to address the board on something on today's agenda? Seeing no one move into the microphone, consideration of minutes. We have minutes from both the union negotiation on the 4th and our regular board meeting on the 2nd.
Move approval.
Second.
A motion and second. Any discussion? Toot.
Aye.
Clinton.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Minutes pass. Consideration of personnel actions. We do have one added personnel action form.
Move approval. Second.
Have a motion and a second. Toot.
Aye.
Clinton.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Personnel actions pass. Consideration of claims.
Good. Move approval.
Second.
Further discussion. Clinton.
Aye.
Toot.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. Claims pass. Consent agenda. Board, with your approval, I would like to pull item number 6 on the consent agenda for us to discuss right after we dispose of the rest of it.
Sounds good. Move approval of the consent agenda with noted changes.
Second.
Clinton.
Aye.
Toot. Sanders, aye. Consent agenda passes. That brings us to item number 6, which is consideration of acquiring an easement for temporary impoundment of water at Dakin's Lake. I'd ask Mike Cox and Jessica to come up. I know this is something we've been working through, and just with Mr. Chitty here, I wanted us to be able to pull this and talk about it for a minute.
Okay. Well, good morning, everyone. You're absolutely right. Something that we've been working through for a little bit of time, and
pull it a little close. There you go.
We have this action before you here this morning to have you authorize us entering this easement with Mr. and Mrs. Chitty. They are adjoining landowners on the north side of Dakin's Lake. And with the lake expansion, we found out that we needed to cross some I's and dot some T's. Try the other way around.
Right.
And
The I's were crossed and the T's were dotted.
There you go. It'll work. At any rate, in order to get our permits to do the lake expansion, build a new lake, and so we've had some discussions with Mr. and Mrs. Chitty, and they've been gracious enough to give us an easement that we need, which would allow us to temporarily impound water in the case of a high water event on their land, which would be just upstream of the lake. So can't say thank you enough to the Chitties for their understanding of the situation we're in, for their cooperation over the years. They've been the landowners there for many years now, I think since the early 70s, 40s.
1940, a little bit before my time.
Yeah, before that lake was, the first lake was even constructed. But at any rate, they've been wonderful to work with, and they are now agreeing to give us this easement to do that, that will enable the project. So just want to thank them for being able to move this forward, which will be a tremendous asset for Zeering, for the county, and for, in fact, greater Central Iowa.
I know sometime when you came before, you gave us kind of a general timeline, but with this now hurdle being cleared, what do you see as the next steps in the process? And I know this has been something discussed at the Conservation Board as well, but how what could you share in that regard?
I can share that our goal right now, and I have yet to discuss some of this with Ms. Reynolds, but we are probably looking at a April 23rd action item for the board to authorize us to publish bids. So we do still have this action item today. We'll set some wheels in motion at the DNR for them to issue permits, and I expect that we will have those permits by the 18th.
Good. And we need a good construction winter of 2013. Well, Mr. Chitty, on behalf of the Board of Supervisors, we want to just thank you for your willingness to work with us and get all the I's dotted and T's crossed. This is going to be a great project, and we are really appreciative of your willingness to help us out with this. So, anything, Ball?
No. Move approval of the consideration of acquiring easement for a temporary impoundment of water at Dakin's Lake.
Second that.
Further discussion. Clinton?
Aye.
Toot?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. With our thanks. Public hearing items. Today we have second consideration of Ordinance 221. Charlie.
We really have nothing to add from the presentation last week. We haven't heard any further public comment on that at all. What we will do from here, if it does move forward today, get the landowner to sign that conditional rezoning agreement and have that ready for next week. So that's the only update I have.
Questions?
No, none.
All right. If there are no questions, I will open the public hearing for consideration on Ordinance 221. And ask if there's anyone who would like to address the board. Seeing no one moving to the microphone, I will close the public hearing and turn to the board and ask your pleasure.
I'll move approval of Ordinance 221 on the second reading and ask that we waive the third reading.
I will second the motion.
All right, it has been moved.
I think we have. Do we have to go the three here?
Yeah, because this is a conditional rezoning agreement. We need the signature from the applicant prior to.
So if you rescind that second part of it, then.
I'll amend my motion to just include the approval on the second reading and third. Set the third reading for the
16th.
April 16th.
As a seconder, I will accept the amendment.
All right, we have a motion to approve Ordinance 221 and have their third and final reading on the 16th. Further discussion? Hearing none. Toot?
Aye.
Clinton?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. Passes. We'll do third and final reading on the 16th. Additional items. Discussion and consideration of restoring funding for MHDS services effective April 1st through the end of the fiscal year.
Yes. Good morning.
How you doing?
Good. How are you guys? Good. This is phase two of our transition funds. We have received the funds. Lucy Martin indicated yesterday that the check was received, and so it was a total of $752,700. And we had a technical assistance conference call with the Department of Human Services last Thursday. Still have some questions. And through the efforts of ISAC, they are trying to set up another conference call that would be available statewide for sometime later this week. And hopefully we would have DHS Director Chuck Palmer and the Division Director Rick Schultz participating in that call as well to just answer some minor questions and get some clarification on some things. But for the purposes of the item that's on the agenda, there were services that the county had either reduced funding or cut funding towards, In the case of cutting the funding, United Way of Story County had stepped up and has been funding some of those services in the meantime until we knew what was going on with transition funds. And those services that United Way has helped out with are the Wellness Center through NAMI, ARCS, Active Lifestyles Program, and then Legal Aid. Other services that we had cut or reduced funding towards was the Transitional Living Program. Instead of reserving two beds each month, we dropped down to one bed. Voluntary hospitalizations, we would like funding restored for those services. And then basic needs services, which would primarily cover rent and utilities. Now, those services, in addition to those that United Way was assisting with, total to about $40,000 for the remaining fiscal year, so April 1st through June 30th. And then we also have the wait list, which we'll address in the next item.
Questions for Deb?
Okay. I would move the consideration for restoring funding, move the restoring funding for the MHDS service effective 4/1/13 as presented.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Further discussion? Hearing none. Clinton?
Aye.
Toot?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. Restored. Next item is rescinding the waiting list.
The waiting list. And the document that I had submitted is a copy of the document that the board used to implement the waiting list that was effective July 1st of 2012. And those services on that waiting list that people who are new to the system could not access right away are adult daycare, adult day services, enclave, residential care facility, residential care facilities for the mentally retarded, which the new term is now intellectual disabilities, supervised apartment living, supported community living, supported employment, and then transportation for purposes other than medical, mental health, or benefit appointments, work activity, and sheltered work. To date, we have four individuals on our waiting list. We did have five, but learned that that individual is in the process of moving away from the area, so we did take that name off the waiting list. So we have four individuals, and my rough estimate of the services that they're requesting between the middle of April through June 30th would total about $7,300. So we'd be able to then remove those individuals from the waiting list and just do away with the waiting list altogether, knowing that we might have to go back and revisit that depending on actions in the legislature for funding for fiscal year 14.
Very good. Questions for Deb?
Yeah, so basically this just allows us to restore this current year, and then any new folks coming into the system currently right now, there is no slot for them until we know how funding is going to be generated through legislative action for this upcoming FY 13-14. Is that correct?
For the current year, we want to, the services listed on the document, we want to make those available and no longer have a waiting,
right,
have to implement the waiting list and remove those four individuals from the current waiting list. If we need to go back to the waiting list for fiscal year 14, that would be something I would come to the board with then prior to the beginning of.
Right, but this would take care of those four individuals and anybody else who comes forward the rest of this fiscal year.
Exactly.
This year.
Yep.
Okay, great.
Yep.
So it still would allow a slot for them. Okay,
yep.
Great. Okay.
And estimated about $7,000.
I would move that we rescind the waiting list for MHDS.
Second.
Have a motion and a second. Further discussion? Toot.
Aye.
Clinton?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. We no longer have a waiting list. That's good. Before you get away, could I ask, I think you shared with me yesterday opinion from the state auditor that there's a possibility of utilizing these transition dollars to reimburse Medicaid services that we've already paid this year.
Non-Medicaid services.
Non-Medicaid,
yes,
services that we've already paid this year. I would just ask that you and Jessica look into that further and come back and talk to us about it as we look at this $752,000.
Right. I believe that that will be part of this conference call, too, that ISAC is trying to set up with DHS just to get clarification on that. But, yes, we will make sure we get a more formal response.
Very good. Thanks.
Thank you.
Appreciate your help through all of this. It's nice to feel like we're getting close to the end.
Yes, it is.
Next item, discussion and consideration of FY14 Iowa DOT Secondary Road 5-Year Construction Program. Darren in a tie. You're throwing me off a little, Darren.
Good morning.
Good morning.
This is a follow-up from last week, our discussion on the 5-year program last week, and I do need board approval today to meet the April 15th deadline. So we had a few issues left to talk about today. We left a week in between for public comment. I did receive a few comments. I'll address those as we go through the three items I had left to discuss. The first was moving 600 and Grant Avenue to FY17. We had it in the fifth year. And the board said, let's just have it progress on up. So it'd be in the fourth year now, so that was an easy change. So both of those projects are now in FY17. Second item was 600th Avenue, changing that to a farm-to-market system. Let me pull up a slide here. I guess before I get going on that, we did have one public comment referring to this item and basically asking a question why we would spend the money to pave this road and or go through the effort to reclassify this as a farm-to-market road if the DOT is planning on closing access to the road in 5 to 10 years. So this is the discussion we're having with that 600th Avenue right here. This is the green lines are the farm-to-market system, so we were looking for possible roads to take off this system, and there's only two that I could identify that were viable options to take off.
What about the one that goes through Fernald?
Fernald.
So it's right there where it makes the jog.
I mean, it's the one that goes straight east and west through Fernald, if I'm looking at the right one.
Correct. I'm just trying to think how the committee is going to view a paved road. Once it's paved, I think it's going to be more difficult to get it off because you could essentially use foreign market funds to pave a road and then take it off the system and work your way down. So it's much harder to do that.
And so the gravel over, so the road over there east of Colo is still gravel, so we won't run into that.
Correct. This is an aerial photo of the 1 mile right here. This is Highway 30 and this is Lincoln Highway up here. We have a railroad crossing in the middle. There is one business right here, real close to 30. And there is a house. It's a newer house right here, just north of Highway 30 also. But not a lot else. There's a radio tower or something up here is what that is. But and the railroad crossing here has got a big hill on it. So to pave that mile ever would be difficult with that in there. And the railroad has been pushing to close as many of those roads between State Center and Colo as they can. The small numbers are ADTs. This has 40 vehicles a day, and this is the road we're talking about right here in yellow. That's on the farm-to-market system, or the yellow roads. This is a level B road for us. It shows 15 per day, but it's Colo Boggs area, and it's level B, so it doesn't get much use. This is just a county line, so there is no road there. So between Colo and State Center is not a lot of north-south roads to connect. So that is a bit of a concern of mine on this particular road. So in my opinion, I'm leaning more towards the other one. And that is down south, again, on 730th Avenue from here up to here. Just one farmstead here, but no really other bridges or anything like that on that mile that would really require farm market funds. again, the Farnham Market map in yellow. Again, kind of the same concern. It's a long distance here. We have without a north-south route, but lower traffic volumes. It ranges 20 to 35 here. Actually have a higher ADT over just a mile to the west. I did consider making that Farnham Market and taking this off, but we'd be short like a quarter of a mile, unfortunately. But that would have worked out nice.
Darren, help educate me a little here. If it's not a paved road, if we don't have any real intention of paving it, how is it going to change our maintenance on that road if it's not Farm to Market?
Very little. The only thing, as I mentioned last time, something we haven't done in a long time is use Farm to Market funds to put rock on the road. I'd like to start doing that, so that could be an impact, but we'd still put rock on this road.
But no change over the way we have been operating.
No. Just opens the doors up mostly to construction-type funding.
Right.
Yep. Wouldn't see a lower level of service, that's for sure.
And so for anybody who utilizes this road, whether it's Farm to Market or not, they shouldn't notice any change over the way they've seen it the last 10 or 15 years.
No. So that's essentially the two options I have, and I guess I would need some guidance from the board if you want me to proceed with this Farm to Market application to the board asking to change either one of these.
Well, Darren, could you check the 600 Avenue and the proposed discussion that the DOT is having on 30? The U.S. Coalition for along that area, I do not recall whether this has been part of one of the earlier priorities within the 5 to 10 year discussion. And I realize that a lot of the earlier discussion had to do with what's happening east of us near 380 and all of the area there because of the tremendous industrial traffic and businesses that are there. Looking at how funding is generated and going back over a number of years, I think the idea of open discussion, the reality is that this may not be a 10-year project. It may be pushed out much further than that.
Don't know.
Which we don't know. So I'm just curious in terms of is it going to be depending upon other industrial development that comes into this area that may speed up that process? What's your take? What's your best guesstimate of what would it take for them to perhaps move this project up further if they really want to talk about cutting off that access and changing all of this?
I don't know if that's going to have as big an impact. The coalition's more interested in areas that aren't four-laned yet. This is more of a DOT goal here is to get that, and they're looking. They don't want to have stoplights out there in the future on a high-speed road in a stoplight condition with get so much traffic. So they're trying to limit the access, and right now all we know is 5 to 10 years out, and actually they're trying to get this in place prior to the industrial development so they don't take up the corner, four corners, so they can't put interchanges in. So they're just trying to get out ahead of that. So at this point, it's just one of the DOT's goals. And
I think their goal is not to have any grade crossings at all.
That's correct, yeah.
As few as they can. As they can manage. I mean, you go east from Webster City on 20 towards the interstate, there's no grade crossings.
Right.
They're all interchange or overpasses.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. Okay.
But as I understand it, this is not part of DOT's 5-year plan. Darren, in our meeting with them, it didn't even really sound like it was part of the next 10 years. Could maybe squeeze into there, but realistically, they were looking out 12 to 15 years is what I recall from our meeting with them. And just to address, I think it was Mr. Shook that sent us the question, just to address my thinking for Mr. Shook, because I think that's important that we do as a board. The reality for me right now is, with the co-op, with Lincoln Way Energy, with DuPont beginning this construction, with the city of Ames still looking at expanding all the way out to 590th and going industrial there. The reality is, right now you've got 580th as a really good north-south. It's going to remain, in some version, regardless of what DOT does, something near 580th is going to remain. But that takes us over, you've got 590th, 600th, which are both gravel roads. 590th has the problem of the bridge that we would have to replace. 600th is a straight shot, no bridges, no anything. And then you go over to Airport Road, which is fine, except it's curb and gutter, so we can't really use it as a true north-south for agricultural equipment. So it leaves us with, okay, do you want our people working in agriculture from the south of 30, do you want them coming through Nevada? Do you want them going all the way over to 580th or whatever 580th turns into in the future? Or is it reasonable to start to believe that, no, we need one more north-south crossing somewhere in there in order to service the area that's already there in the co-op, Lincoln Way Energy, and DuPont, and what we expect it's going to look like in the next 10 or 15 years? And that's where I come down and I say, okay, DOT gets to do what DOT does, but we as county supervisors have the responsibility of identifying what our grid system ought to look like. And when I look at the map, when you have the full-blown map up there, and I say the realities of use right now is that 600th or 590th need to be a north-south route for truck traffic and agricultural traffic. And that's how I get where I'm going. Now, DOT could throw a wrench into all this, but we just don't know that yet. And so I don't know if you guys
and 590th is that where Hullups is that's further
east? No, 590th is where Vetter built their new building.
Right. And we only did just that little small portion.
Just to
there.
Get to the entrance.
Right.
And that would be fine for going north-south if it wasn't for the bridge. But, I mean, that's another, Darren, roughly another $500,000 to get that thing.
Oh, that's not a real big bridge, so that might be $200,000 to $300,000.
Okay, but it's $200,000 to $300,000 that we wouldn't have to spend on 600th.
Yeah, correct.
So that's
it sounds like you know, these are a couple of scenarios that we really need to fully to understand and then try to give a direction in terms of what our priorities should be. And. And the question would be is looking at the 5-year plan, we have included it in there, but the question would be is whether we want to move it up a little bit in order to, if that becomes one of our primary options. Is that correct?
We wouldn't be able to do it without making a farm market road.
So we have to do that. Yes.
So, as I see it, and Darren, just correct me if I'm missing something here. The first step, and I'm just talking about keeping, and for me it's 600th, keeping 600th in the conversation, we'd have it 4 years out on our 5-year plan. We would start the process of pulling a farm to market road 1 mile somewhere to put it on 600th, which, again, doesn't commit us to anything, but it gives us some flexibility. And then we start to get a year, 2 years down the road. Then all of a sudden, if it keeps moving up on the plan, it's becoming reality. But we're going to know more of what DOT is doing by that point. And so all I'm suggesting is that we keep it there, that we go after the farm to market designation, because I don't think we're hurting ourselves by removing it, as Darren suggests. And it opens our options up to us. It doesn't commit us to anything. And so, if Darren, if you're seeing it differently than I am, please let these guys know now.
That's a good explanation. I don't see it doesn't really hurt these roads, but it's more whether we pave it or not. Making it farm to market's not that big of a deal.
Right, but this doesn't commit us to paving it. It just puts it on there.
And I think that's important right now, is as we are beginning to explore the options further. It makes a lot more sense.
I think it's important that we keep sight of that, because the only thing the DOT knows for sure is that in 2017 they're going to change the intersection at 30 and 35.
Exactly.
Other than that, there's not a dime that's been committed to any of the rest of it.
Exactly.
And
right.
I know that they've gotten some buy-in from Nevada. I think Nevada's chosen one plan over the other that they like for the configuration of the intersection there at 30 and on the south side of Nevada. But other than that, that's it. And I think if we hold ourselves hostage trying to figure out what the DOT is going to do, we're never going to move forward at all. So I think this is it's a good idea. I think that's where the growth is going to continue to occur out there with the ethanol plant and whatever else Ames decides to do in that corridor. So to me, it makes sense to at least start the process by doing the application, see if we can get 600 put in the farm to market program.
We agree the one down southeast there would be the.
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, I trust your judgment on that one. If you think that's the one that we pull, I mean, I wanted to underscore, we're not talking about maintaining that road any differently than we currently maintain it. We're just talking about changing the designation.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay, the next item I had was the 250th Street Bridge near Hickory Grove. We received a couple additional comments on that bridge that we currently have closed. One from Hertz Farm Management, who has their headquarters. It's just about a mile to the west of the bridge. And then we received additional comments from Conservation, Mike Cox, saying that this is a route they use a lot, but he did add what we discussed earlier, that of more importance would be that Skunk River Bridge up north. So if we got to get into weighing this bridge or that bridge, that's more important than up on 150th Street to him. But
well, now remind me, 250th, the structure that's there now, is it salvageable?
I don't believe so.
So we're talking about taking what's there all the way out and putting something new in, and you think that's going to be a $700,000-ish?
Probably $600,000 bridge with another $100,000 of cost on the side that has to go into that. So, yeah, $700,000 in the end.
Okay, so regardless of where we go permanently on that bridge, what's the soonest we can get to something like that? If the board were to decide, yeah, we want to keep that bridge, that's a vital part of what's going on in Story County, how long would it be before you could work it into the program?
Okay, your options for keeping the bridge or putting a new bridge in would be, like I say, right now it's not eligible for federal funding, but I believe the next cycle is going to make it eligible. So we got to wait for that, for one. But two, it's not on a farm market system. So we can't match the 20% with farm market funds. We call that an 8J project. What 8J means, we have to budget the entire amount in our local budget, and it gets reimbursed. So we've already approved our FY14 local budget, so it can't be an FY14. So the earliest it could be was FY15, and we'd have to budget the entire $600,000 or $700,000 local dollars, and then we'd get reimbursed 80% of that, but 20 come out of our local budget.
Okay, so this what it sounds to me like, regardless of where we know we won't be doing anything between now and the start of FY15. Which is really part of our budget conversation when we start the FY15 budget conversation. So is it reasonable, Darren, that between now and then, so now and the end of calendar year 2013, that we can start to have the discussion of what kind of reasonable grid system we can have on our bridges and just see where this one fits?
True. My only concern is a bridge of that size does take probably 2 years to design and get through all the approval process. So we kind of need to know just about 2 years in advance if we're going to do the bridge or not. So it's not just the funding side of it. It's the design and survey and all that goes into a bridge. So we probably need 2 years in advance to get a new bridge out there.
But we're not going to know for sure whether it qualifies for federal funding till we get to that new cycle. Is that right, or are you just really confident?
We should know that within the next year.
Yeah.
The bridge report that's going in is recommending it. They just have to approve it, and I don't know of any cases where they don't go along with what our recommendation was, so that should happen.
But until we know that, I would suggest for me, until I know whether it's eligible for federal funding, it's going to be hard for me to pull the trigger.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So we're a year out on knowing that.
Correct.
And then 2 years from the time we determine we're actually doing the bridge. So what I'm hearing you say is we're 3 years out minimum on putting anything new in there, if we put anything new in there.
That's a good estimate, yep.
So
what options is available for the area if the bridge basically, as you say, is structurally deficient, and so it's going to be temporarily restrictive Now, when you say close or restrictions on it, that is for certain types of implementary, or is it just like any cars and so forth would not be what should be posted, that they shouldn't be going across it at all?
No, this bridge is going to be closed to all vehicles. Yes, it already is, and there's no way to repair it to that point. I guess to address some of Hurt's comments, that bridge has been posted 10 tons for a long time. I don't know how many years, but it's been that way a long time. And the bridge to the north, they commented, and it's only 18-foot wide, the bridge we're talking about. The bridge to the north, they said, has a width restriction. That's wider than this bridge. It's 19.5, and it carries heavier loads. So the width and load issues up there are better than the bridge they've been using. So,
is that the one that's just around the corner from the north of this one?
It's straight north. Right around the corner is a concrete bridge, but then it heads back. It's, what, 248 jog? Yeah. That's what they'd have to use to come down off of 30.
So really, big farm implements have not been using this bridge, or not appropriately using this bridge for the last...
They shouldn't have been using
it
for a long time.
Okay, so help me understand. It sounds like from the letter you had received, it's more or less a question of access to continue. So looking at farmers and other landowners there, is there ways that people could get a temporary easement that would allow them to navigate around rather than having to go for, what is it, extra mile and a half to 2 miles to get to that area? Are these things that's ever talked about when there are restrictions that are placed on roads due to bridge construction and so forth?
There's really, yeah, no way to have an easement around it because you still have to cross the river somewhere.
Still got to cross the river.
And specifically with Hertz, they can get, they're on the side, their property's on the side of their home base there, so they can get to that. I think it's more the issue they have so many other areas over there.
Right.
I don't know where they are, but just getting over that section of the county. So, but going north is an option, but that puts them on Highway 30, so I understand their concern with getting on 30. But going south, there is a narrow bridge down there, too. That one's 16, but the rails are only 3 foot high or so, so they may or not be able to get through that. I'm not sure, so that might be a valid concern. But
it's something they should have been dealing with for the last few years. I mean, that's been their headquarters for years. This bridge has not been adequate for them to really take their big equipment across for the last few years.
Right.
So it's not like they're going to have to be doing something this year that they haven't been doing in previous years.
Correct. So as far as the five-year program discussion goes, I just wanted to point out it's not in the program right now, but like Rick said, we need some more discussion on future bridge replacements, what kind of system we're going to end up with here. Need to have that discussion before we can decide if this bridge is going to go on or not, and we can have that hearing to actually close the bridge with the understanding we may or may not close it at that hearing, just so we get more public input. I think we need more public input before you can make that decision on the closure.
Sure.
On that.
But temporarily, I mean, for this whole season at least, that thing's closed and it's going to be
right.
Closed.
Yeah, it's a 63-year-old bridge. It's all wood. Well, there's got steel beams and they're rusting already. But the wood itself, that's about the lifespan of the wood. So putting a lot of money into that bridge, 18-foot wide, and it'd probably just get us back to that 10-ton posting anyway. So that, I don't think it solves our problem.
Right. What's interesting to me, guys, and I don't know if you got the same phone calls that I got, I received multiple phone calls, but two basic feelings. One was, well, Hertz Farm Management has wanted to be on a dead-end road for years and years, and now they're finally getting it. And then the other one was Hertz saying, wait a minute, we want this bridge. So the two very, very clearly don't go together. For me, it's just a matter of, is this a bridge that Story County needs? And if it is, how are we going to pay for it?
Okay.
I'm kind of interested in how we pay for stuff, if you haven't noticed.
Well, you know, one of the challenges for me is always going to be is when you have limited resources and you have certain areas where you have noticed deficiencies, and what is the tool that you use to evaluate and prioritize which one should be addressed first? When you look at, do you look at the total usage of the area, the size of the farmsteads, all of these types of things? Or do you look at it in terms of other uses, such as the total traffic? I mean, to me, the evaluation part really is something that we haven't gone down that path, and I really think it requires some real careful analysis and discussions about how we begin to prioritize those, but I think it's something we're going to have to do, because I think we're going to have to start identifying which ones we can do with the limited resources and figure that maybe one a year we can actually do. And I think what's important for the public in this one email, I think a lot of the public fail to really understand how the funding is generated. And every year the county transfers the maximum allowable from the general fund to the secondary roads. And so we're relying upon funding through licenses and so forth. And that's why this discussion about fuel tax would be an important juncture. But I think a lot of times the public just doesn't realize there are restrictions in terms of how roads and bridges receive their funding based on all the different things that the county has to approve. So I don't know. We're just going to have to do a better job of communicating as we move forward.
Two things, Wayne. First of all, I think you're 100% right on your assessment of where we need to go. I would simply add that I believe any conversation like that is going to include multiple evening public meetings to get as much input and encourage as much input. What I would ask of the two of you is I would like to work with Darren and Jessica to put together kind of that matrix that – the decision points that we're going to have to make, what kind of information we're going to need, and ultimately have a big map like this that shows every one of our bridges, and we start to figure out what conversations we're having, what's appropriate. I know there's things happening right now legally that we're going to be interested in as a board as we make some of these decisions. And I just think that over the next 6 months or so, if you would allow Darren and I and Jessica to work through this, we can come back with something for the board to at least to start to decide how we're going to decide, so that we can move through the process.
Sounds good to me.
Well, with that, we have a proposed program that the board will need to take action on.
5-year program.
I'll move approval of the 5-year program as presented.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Further discussion? Hearing none. Toot.
Aye.
Clinton.
Aye.
Sanders. Aye. 5-year program approved. Darren, thanks for your work on this.
Thank you.
And you look good in a tie. Discussion and consideration of equipment rental agreement. Leanne.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We received a phone call from a citizen in Story County last week inquiring as to whether or not he could borrow our pin finder. We have a pin finder that we purchased a number of years ago. That got some conversation started, and long story short, reached out to Joe with IRVM, got a copy of his equipment rental agreement, and really drafted it for planning and development. We have two things we could rent, huge number of materials we could rent, but one would be the pin finder and the other would be the base for the Box City Festival. So we put some dollars down, and then I talked to Paul, and he thought it was wise to bring it forward for discussion and approval. So the agreement just simply specifies the two types of equipment. The Box City would be $10 a day, and that does not include staff time from our department to go set it up. We'd have an information sheet that would go, and it's basically a large puzzle, and they're pre-numbered. And then the other would be the pin finder for $5 a day. The user would agree to that and then be also, through the signature, agree to pay a $20 fee if it was damaged.
What does a pen finder cost? When we bought it many years ago.
I think it was $700-some years ago, and right now it sits in our storage.
Okay. And if I needed a pen finder and we didn't offer a rental program, where would I go to find one?
Some of the hardware stores or a metal detector. I think you can rent those from some hardware stores.
You're not going to rent it for the price that we're giving. But again, we're not using it. We haven't used it for a period of time. And how is this consistent with the rental fee that our VM sets up for some of its?
Well, they have larger equipment that, $25 a day on up. I mean, we're not talking about a machine that will drill holes or the larger equipment they have. The pin finder is just, basically a lengthy metal detector.
It's pretty specific use. If you need a pin finder, you need a pin finder.
Yeah, and I'm all for us helping out citizens, when you need something like this. What I'm not for, and I don't know if this classifies as that, I'm not for us getting into competition with the private sector. If there's somebody out there who rents pen finders, if somebody out there rents pen finders, I'm not wanting us to come in and undercut them or anything like that. But it just seems to me that this is a pretty unique item for a unique purpose, hard to find, and it makes sense to me that we would offer it to citizens. And
I don't see this being either of these items of equipment being high demand items. I think
the Box City is one of a kind, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, but we haven't had people knocking at our door for either of these. Yeah, actually, until last week, no one had ever asked to borrow a pin finder.
And we're not going to market it or anything like that, are we? I mean, you want to have a way to do this if somebody calls you.
Well, let me ask. Yeah, I was going to ask Jessica. Did you see? Are we perhaps opening up a can of worms here that we don't want to go down?
I'd like a chance to review the rental agreement as proposed, if that would be okay with the board.
Yeah, and I do know IRVM has done this for a number of years on just certain pieces of equipment, and we've been fairly fortunate that we've not had any major issues as far as damage that we've needed to have costly repair and so forth.
I think we're going to want to add a replacement cost provision in case the entire thing would be damaged. I can do that really quickly and get it back to Leanne.
Yeah, Leanne, can we just refer this to Jessica and you bring it back next week?
Sure.
Thanks.
Yeah, sounds good. Good.
Outstanding. All right, discussion, acknowledge receipt of the preliminary FIS and firm issued to Story County and discussion of the 30-day community review period. Leanne.
I did bring this up last week at public forum number 2 and said I'd be having on today's agenda to acknowledge receipt of it. We have received the preliminary flood insurance study and flood insurance rate maps for what was the physical map revision, or the PMR, along Worley Creek and College Creeks. So there are two jurisdictions involved. One is Story County and one is the City of Ames. Obviously, we are the unincorporated portions of the flood insurance study. This does trigger the receipt of the letter that was to the chair as well as myself, triggers official timeframes that go into play. So as of March 29th, we are in the 30-day comment period that runs through April 29th. This is our opportunity to provide back to the FEMA contractor any possible changes we see in boundaries, city limits, street names. We cannot offer comments on the base flood elevations that are provided in the study. That's a different period. So this first 30-day period, we're really looking to make sure the names are right. We really are not questioning the boundaries. The second period will then begin once we are notified of a formal community coordination meeting. I have not received any notice from FEMA on that yet, but it should be happening any day. They'll invite the Board of Supervisors, City of Ames, and Story County staff as well to sit down. We have a statutory 90-day appeal period after that. That is where we can appeal the information in the flood insurance study. Whether it's accepted or not, I mean, our track record has not been the best, but this is a different contract with FEMA. It's a very, very concentrated effort for a flood insurance study. I just bring this up today. One, you need to acknowledge receipt of it. Two, I just want to take an opportunity to let you know what the implications may be long term. In the next year, the 90-day appeal period, three months, the 90-day appeal period will be running. Following that, we'll get draft flood insurance and firm maps. That will be about 7 to 10 months from now, so February of 2014. We may be looking at that. You'll have to go through a formal adoption process as an ordinance to the floodplain management program. But kind of in tandem to this, on a larger federal level, the Biggert Waters Act was adopted and went into effect in 2002. The official name is the Flood Insurance Reform Act of 2012. This is going to substantially affect flood policies nationwide. The risks are going to be more real, to reflect real risks, rather than the past practice where estimated risks have been. But short story, flood insurance policies will probably on average go up 25% annually, a huge increase. And it will begin to affect more policy and non-policy holders. It will be implemented specifically in October 2013, and then what has been known as a grandfathering clause will go into effect in 2014. Bring this up because we will be at Story County. I think it's to our benefit to very closely coordinate with those property owners within this flood insurance study amendment that will be affected by that, because this isn't just not $5 a month. In some cases, this could be upwards of $600+ a month. I mean, it is a huge increase, and it really is to bring the risks that are associated with the National Flood Insurance Program, are the costs associated in line with the real risks. As you well know, we've had a number of natural disasters over the past few years of directly related to flooding, and it has taken its toll on the program. We don't deal with the insurance end of it, but I think it's to the county's benefit to make sure that those property owners that will be affected by your ordinance amendment that you are required to do will be taking on possibly more costs. So I will keep you up to date on that. Today, again, is just to
acknowledge
the receipt, and I want to...
And I have the copy in my office on the little table there,
yeah,
so if you guys want to take a look at it for the board.
While acknowledging receipt of this information is easy, I just want to make sure I understand. So we're at the beginning of a 30-day period where we can question it, basically if something's mislabeled on the map,
right.
If they've misnamed something, if a boundary is wrong.
Right.
But we can't talk at all at this point about there's no way that this section of ground is in the floodplain.
Yeah.
That goes after that 30 days for another 90 days.
That's the and it's not just 30 into 90. There will be a period of time in between that 30-day. The 30-day we're in right now, and it gets a little bit complicated because we had to follow our own requirements for publication, but we also have to follow federal register requirements for publication. So once we have that community coordination meeting, then the 90-day appeal period will begin after the second publication.
Okay.
So that's the fluid number that I don't know. All I know is we're in the 30-day. Next will be the 90-day.
Okay.
And then 7 to 10 months from that end will be the maps.
And then just anecdotally, how did they do? How many requests for items that are mislabeled are we going to make?
I haven't even looked at it yet. I haven't looked at it. What I will say is this time around, again, it's a more focused effort. It's not a countywide amendment. It's in an area where... I hesitate to say this, but almost anything could be better what we've had.
Yeah.
Burley Creek did not even match up to the actual creek, the floodplain.
Right.
On Chilean
and
map,
that was
so.
Where I wanted you to go just to educate these two. You know, the last time we went through all this process, we had, along with the city of Ames, we identified some inaccuracies. But yet there was no way that they were going to change the outcome of what we had put forth. And so we went through all of this gathering of information, reviewing all of this, but the whole bureaucracy of trying to actually get them to recognize that, you know, this doesn't match up with the reality of what the map shows, it was just a frustrated effort on the part of everybody, and especially
by
Leanne.
By the utility on our end.
Yeah.
They were not willing. And, you know, fortunately for this specific area of Story County, we'll have very good detailed maps with detailed information.
Right. Unfortunately, well, and when you add to it, Leanne, the fact that rates are going to go up as dramatically as they're going to go up on the people that are affected by this, we owe it to do everything we can to make sure that the maps are at least accurate. So I think this is an important process we got to go through, and I appreciate you leading it.
And I hope that in the future, too, we'll have a conversation as to what we can do with the rest of the county in line with what's happening with the Flood Insurance Reform Act of 2012 and how we notify those property owners if we do. And now, those aren't even numbers I could begin to give you yet.
Thank you very much. All right, we need to acknowledge receipt.
Okay, move. Okay, second.
Got a motion and a second. Further discussion? Toot.
Aye.
Clinton?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. We acknowledge receipt. Next item, consideration of preliminary subdivision plat of Bella Woods, located on lands under the ownership of James and Karen Clark, Section 20 of Franklin. Hi, Charlie.
Bella Woods.
Good morning. Let me get this back up here real quick.
As you had mentioned, this is reviewing the preliminary plat of the Bella Woods subdivision, property owner being James and Karen Clark. Property location, it's in Section 20 of Franklin Township at 3491 Cameron School Road, a little over 19 acres in size. It's currently zoned R1 residential and has been since May of 1976. Board of Supervisors did rezone it from the A1 district on that date. It is classified as a residential use as it does contain one single-family dwelling. The fringe plan does designate it as rural transitional residential in both Ames and Gilbert within 2 miles. However, since Ames is closer, Ames does have the review jurisdiction over it. It is to consider a major subdivision plat of one current subdivision lot. It's going to be broken into 15 developable lots, one of which will have the current single-family dwelling placed on it, so 14 new residences. This is an update. There is actually now 3 outlots on it. I'll explain that in a little bit, and then 2 street lots. This is the map of the zoning in the area. You can see the general Squaw Creek area here, all zoned R1 residential, a little bit down here as well. Cameron's Pines Estates here in the AR, agricultural residential, and the subject property we're looking at, mainly vacant right here, but also zoned R1 residential. Just a few side shots we have here. This is actually looking onto the driveway entrance of the current single-family dwelling right now off of Cameron School Road. So when looking kind of up the driveway, that'll generally be where the new road will be placed. This one looking back down the road and kind of gives you a good idea of the amount of trees on the site there, too. This looks at the current single-family dwelling that will be placed on one of the lots. This one looks down on the pond that is located in the southeast corner of the site. This one on the pond in the southwest corner of the site. I'll get into those a little bit more here. The next few pictures here are just really going to show you kind of the amount of the trees that are on the site and one of the concerns that we'll have with those, and I'll explain that here in a little bit as well. As we noticed, there is an existing single-family dwelling located on the site. It is proposed to be placed on Lot 15. The preliminary plat does show conformance with all setback regulations for that proposed lot. We did note that the final plat will need to show the building footprint and the setback figures for that single-family dwelling. The subdivision does include the dedication of 2 street lots to be used for public roads. The primary street will be a north-south road. It'll be named Bella Woods Drive, which will provide access to the site from Cameron School Road. Cameron School Road is an existing paved county road, as you do know. It does carry approximately 3,000 vehicles per day. We did note with that typically a new single-family dwelling does generate about 10 vehicle trips per day. So with this subdivision, you'd see less than a 5% increase in traffic on Cameron School Road. Bellwoods Drive will provide frontage for up to 11 of the 15 lots. It will extend to the north line where it will be quote-unquote stubbed in for a connection to the parcel to the north for any future development of that parcel. That stubbed-in portion will essentially be a dead-end road until that future connection is made, and that dead-end segment will be approximately 280 feet and will have frontage for up to 3 lots. Bellwoods Drive does provide a 66-foot right-of-way with a 26-foot roadway and a 6-inch curb. The roadway will have a ditch on both sides that will be approximately 30 feet wide and 3 feet deep. The second street is proposed to be approximately 250-foot cul-de-sac named Bella Circle that will provide frontage for up to 6 lots. The roadway portion of Bella Circle will have the same specs as Bella Woods Drive, with the circular portion having a 60-foot radius right-of-way with a 50-foot radius paved portion. In all those street lots, which will be the total right-of-way, will consume approximately 13% of the site. One kind of unique circumstance with the subdivision, when this third addition was platted in 1990 of South Squaw Subdivision, did include a street reservation easement that was intended to be an easement used for future street extension of Matthews Road, which is directly to the west of this subdivision, but it was to connect Matthews Road to the east to meet up with this proposed subdivision. The easement was depicted on that plat that was approved in 1990, and mention of the easement was made in the recorded restrictive covenants, which did state that the owners of the street reservation easement shall convey or dedicate those portions of the easement in the event Matthews Road is extended in an easterly direction in the future. Those covenants were recorded in October of 1990, and they did expire 21 years later. We did note that we have not found any evidence that they were continued after those 21 years, so those are assumed to be expired. With that, there are concerns with our department and with a lot of other departments, the county's ability to force conveyance of that easement since the covenants are expired. However, Ames City Council did approve the preliminary plat for the Bellawood subdivision a couple Tuesdays ago on March 26. They did place a condition that the development include a 60-foot outlot that will stretch west of the Bellawood Circle to the west property line of the subject property. That outlot will serve the purpose of providing a future connection for Bella Circle to that 60-foot street reservation easement that stretches off Matthews Road. We did want to note that the city probably would have the ability upon annexation to require that street reservation easement be conveyed for right-of-way from Matthews Road, especially if it's a voluntary annexation. Again, the county probably doesn't have any way to get that conveyance of that easement. So with that, we did want to note that it's safe to assume that Bella Circle will remain a cul-de-sac with no connection to Matthews Road while the proposed development is located in unincorporated Story County. However, if annexation does occur in the future, the city may attempt to connect Bella Circle with Matthews Road. However, at that point, it would be outside the county's jurisdiction, and the issues of road names, addresses, and infrastructure improvements would fall under the jurisdiction of the City of Ames. Looking at common open space in the subdivision, it does include three outlots, one 2.4 acres in size, and two that'll be approximately a quarter acre in size. That does total 3 acres of common open space, or about 15.75% of the subdivision. Those numbers are a little bit different than what we include in the staff report because there was a change that was made since the Planning and Zoning Commission meeting. We did note that the county does require 15%, so this area is met. There are obviously a large number of trees on this site, which will undoubtedly have to be moved or removed from the site when the road is placed and the homes are built. The applicant has stated that the disturbance of grade in trees will be limited to the street corridor and that the homes will be custom for each homeowner, and they will determine how the home will fit among the trees on his or her lot. A significant tree is defined as a deciduous tree with a caliper of greater than 4 inches, measured 4 feet off the ground. Where it is not feasible to protect and retain the significant trees or transplant them to another on-site location, replacement trees shall be planted on-site or in the closest available planting site within a quarter mile. I wanted to show you just a few pictures, and these were provided by the applicant. This of the site in year 1994, you can see there are little to no trees located on the site back in 1994. This here in 2003, you can see again an enormous amount of tree planting has taken place within those 9 years. And then here, just last year in 2012, you can see how those trees that were planted there in 2003 have really matured. The development shall incorporate stormwater control strategies that better replicate natural watershed hydrology and water quality. We did note that ditches along the road will be used as the primary route for stormwater runoff for this site and will essentially be used as biofilters and planted in a vegetative matter. Those ditches will flow into the two existing pond areas on the site, and the southwest pond will serve as the site's stormwater detention pond. The stormwater management plan does state that stormwater will be routed through roadway ditches and culverts and will be designed for driveway crossings. And currently, a majority of the site does drain into the pond located in the southeast corner and then route stormwater into the pond in the southwest corner via a 12-inch outlet. Water on the east side of proposed Bellwoods Drive will discharge over land flow and through driveway culverts into the existing pond in the southeast corner. The overflow for that pond is currently handled through an emergency spillway on the southwest corner that does flow into Cameron School Road, the ditch of the Cameron School Road. The applicant is proposing constructing a new manhole to be installed on that 12-inch outlet, and then from the manhole there will be an 18-inch concrete pipe installed to convey the water into the pond on the southwest corner from that overflow area. There will be a second 15-inch pipe that will be installed to an intake located at the bottom of the pond spillway to handle any overflow and divert it into the pond in the southwest quarter. We did note that during a 100-year storm, the 12-inch outlet will not be sufficient and the pond will overflow to the previously discussed intake. Water on the west side will be discharged overland flow and through the driveway culverts to the pond in the southwest corner. The ultimate discharge point for this site is through the existing 24-inch culvert that empties into the Cameron School roadway ditch and does flow about 0.3 mile into Squaw Creek. The proposed development asphalt roadway adds approximately 1.13 acres of impervious area compared to the existing conditions, and it has been determined that a 15-inch culvert will not overtop any future driveway during the 100-year storm event, and those 15-inch culverts will be what is required throughout this subdivision. I wanted to go back to this picture real quick here. You can see that ultimate discharge point from the site right there. It goes through that pipe. That's that 24-inch pipe that goes into Cameron School Road. And this is the pond that's located in the southwest corner. Just showed some elevation from the LiDAR data we have. Shows the high point on the site here in the red, and you can generally see how the flow of the site does go down into the two ponds and ultimately the low spot being where that pond is there in the southwest corner. This one kind of just goes a little bit further out to show how the stormwater would flow through there naturally right now. Again, you can kind of see how generally it flows into the Cameron School Road here and then Squaw Creek being located right down there. This is the most updated plat that we did receive yesterday. I did include a copy of it for the board on your desk there. We'll show a few new things than the one that we had submitted. First, that I don't know why it keeps doing that. There is a new outlot that was added. You can't really see it right here, but where that pond is there in the southwest corner, there is a new quarter-acre outlot that was added. And speaking with the applicant, that was mainly done to kind of create a buffer from Cameron School Road and allow the applicant and the Homeowners Association the ability to put some plantings in there that make the site more attractive. The other big change from that would be, again, you can see the outlot added that the City of Ames is requiring and the connection it makes to that Matthews Road street reservation easement right there. So at any point that it is annexed, you can see where that connection will be made. Lots 5 and 6 right here mainly will take access off that outlot, and that outlot is also shown on the plat to be used for a shared access easement for those two lots. Lastly, we did want to note that the letter of acknowledgement from the Gilbert Fire Chief did state that the Fire Chief would need to look around to identify any other concerns that he had not done at the point of we received that letter of acknowledgement. From staff standpoint, I think we'd like a follow-up from the Gilbert Fire Chief just to make sure that there is not any major concerns with the subdivision proposal. We also did note that we have not received any proposed covenants for the subdivision, and those are there are various aspects of this plat that require homeowners association commitments to the maintenance and upkeep, especially with things like roads and stormwater management features. So because of that, with this middle of the final plat, I think it's appropriate that staff review those covenants to make sure everything is in line with that. And lastly, the Story County Land Development Regulations do require the developer to enter into a developer's agreement providing for the installation of all improvements with the subdivision. We did note that the agreement shall outline erosion control measures for the development of the site. The agreement shall outline the removal of the significant trees and mitigation of the removal of those significant trees. And the agreement shall outline the soil analysis for septic systems that will be placed on each lot. With that, the Planning and Zoning Commission did review the subdivision last Monday, April 1st. They did recommend approval to the Board of Supervisors with various conditions. I have listed those on the screen there above. Few of those that I did cross out, mainly because those conditions have been met with the submittal of this new plat here. The other ones that still need to be met would be consideration must be given by staff for the trees which have been planted by the developer, and noting that those not being native to the property. Mainly with the removal of the significant trees, the commission really wanted us to kind of alleviate some of the regulation on that because, again, back in 1994, there were no trees on the site. The property owner planted all these trees, and again, with that, making them remove and mitigate the removal of those trees would somewhat be a hardship to the applicant. So for the most part, any indication we've been giving on that is that a majority of those trees are going to stay on site, and of course the subdivision is being called Bella Woods, so I think they want to try to incorporate those trees into the general plan of the site. The other conditions being that the Gilbert Fire Chief must provide a final letter stating that they can provide emergency service. Covenants must be provided to staff for review. The development agreement must include erosion control measures. And then two other things that the commission did add. First of all, that the developer must correct the drain tile issue on the Stallman property, which is located just to the east of this property. It was an issue that I think we were made aware of a couple weeks ago, and there's been some studies done on this in the past about a drain tile issue located on both, I think, Amesy Free Church up there and the Stallman property. But the developer, in principle, has agreed to fix that issue, and every indication has been given that they're going to fix that issue. However, we did note that it probably would be appropriate to include that in a developer's agreement that the board supervisor would ultimately sign. Lastly, a minimum 6-foot high fence must be placed on the common property line between the Stallman property and the proposed development. And again, if the board is comfortable going forward with that condition, we would prefer that be placed in the development agreement as well.
But that doesn't, the 6-foot fence would not have to extend north onto the E3 property.
No, yeah, it was just between the Stallman property and the proposed development is the condition that they raised. So. And with that, the alternatives that we included in the staff report are on the screen there above, and I would be happy to answer any questions you have.
As did you have representatives from the developer at this meeting, and with the conditions, did they have an opportunity to weigh in? Did they find that these were feasible, or did they see that it created any major hardships that we need to at least acknowledge?
Yeah, and the developer is actually here, and you can ask him any of those questions as well. But from me kind of sitting there and listening to the discussion that took place, I don't think that number 7, the correction of the drain tile issue, I think that was something that was already agreed upon prior to the meeting. The fence issue, I think there was a little bit of disagreement on there. The commission really kind of and I don't believe Kathy Stallman's here today, but I think her issue was she has a lot of agricultural activity taking place on that farmstead. She's got some bulls out there, stuff like that, and she just saw a potential liability with anybody climbing or getting onto her property that may get hurt. So ultimately, I think the commission kind of wanted to just create that buffer from the two properties and create that as just a safety feature for it. So.
Okay. Great.
Other questions for Charlie?
No. No. Thank you. No,
anybody no. Like to address us on this today? Now would be the time.
Upper, if you have any. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Bob Gibson. I'm with Civil Design Advantage, representing the developer here, and I guess mostly here just to answer any questions. Pretty much don't have any problem with anything Charlie said. the fence was kind of an issue of disagreement and as to how necessary that really was. I guess we'd prefer not to do that, but we totally understand Kathy Stallman's view on that as well. And she does have goats and rams there, and that was her concern of, you know, bringing a few more homes in there and possibly kids running into her property and getting hurt. The issue regarding the drainage tile, that was something that was kind of came to us late too. We were unaware of that, and when that pond was built, I don't know, 15, 18 years ago, it intercepted that tile, and that tile is actually submerged about 4 feet into the water. So that means that there's water backed up into this tile, and that's caused some issues over the years. So what we're going to do with that is we're just going to catch it before it gets into the pond and route it around the pond and drain it back out to the ditch on Cameron School Road. So,
okay.
But any other questions, I'd be glad to answer.
I mean,
no, just wanted to make sure that the due process and everybody understood the challenges that were laid out, and it sounds like a lot of times when conditions are there, these have been things that have been vetted on numerous occasions, and it's really designed to reduce future problems that may arise, and so I see this as a positive rather than a negative. So I'm pleased that you all are willing to move forward understanding the rationale behind this.
Looks like a fun little subdivision.
Yeah, and there's been a ton of interest. Most lots, if not all of them at this point, are spoken for. And
wow.
Yeah, there's going to be some nice homes out there. So.
Good.
Okay.
I would move approval of recommendation of the Planning and Zoning Commission and approve the preliminary subdivision plat for Bella Woods with conditions as put forth in case SUB 0313.
And I will second that motion.
I have a motion and a second. Further conversation? Hearing none. Toot.
Aye.
Clinton?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye. Preliminary subdivision plat passes. Next item, consideration and discussion between Tyler Technologies and IT for the purchase proposal for Tyler Content Manager Enterprise Edition Software. 5-year agreement, $73,601.
Hiya.
Hi, Barb.
Hi there. I bring to you this proposal because, as you know, we've recently finished our real estate upgrade. And hand-in-hand with that, actually part two, was the content management piece, which was approved and budgeted for 2013. However, before we could move forward, Tyler said, well, we need you to sign that proposal because it was never signed. It was originally presented to Sandra in January 2012, and so we can't really proceed with the proposal until we do get it signed. What this does is it moves the real estate information from our current AS400 system, the VI client, to the real estate parcels that we just converted. So you go look at a parcel, you'll be able to see all the documentation associated with that. Another reason for moving in this direction is that our VI client will no longer be supported in 2015, so we have to move those documents off of the AS400 anyway. And this will also give us a good leap into becoming paperless. I do see, and Tyler has told us that this would be a content management solution that we could use countywide. I'd like to test it and see how it works for this before we decide to move forward and push it. We also have the COFAX scanning that is our second scanning solution. So.
But this is something we approved as part of the budgeting process,
yes.
And now we're just going
right.
back and
planning
yes. it.
Right. And I thought it would be good to review it. I wasn't quite sure if I needed to
Absolutely.
Present, but
yep.
2 years is a long time ago to
Absolutely.
Be talking about something
Absolutely.
And then implementing.
Okay.
I have no questions.
Discussion. Yep. Okay. Action.
Move the agreement between Tyler Technology and Information Technology for the proposed purchase of content management software. For $73,601 as submitted.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Further discussion? Clinton?
Aye.
Toot?
Aye.
Sanders? Aye.
Thank you.
Cleaned up. Thanks, Barb. Agency reports, LSI. I know that Lisa's busy right now. Do we have anybody from LSI today? Okay. Departmental report, engineer. Darren, we haven't seen you in a while. Now I see why you brought a tie.
Now we know why you
yeah.
bought a tie.
double whammy today.
Couple pictures in here. Let me bring this up quick. Okay, well, the spring's finally here. I hope so anyway. They're talking maybe one more snow here, but overall, did you have something, Wayne?
Before you start, has you received any notification? Do you have any idea what's going on 35 on the east side, all the power lines that we see laying out on the fields there, and even all along here, Lincoln Way, you know,
That's been in the makings here for 5-10 years. I believe that's Ames transmission lines going in up there. I know we got utility permits 6-7 years old. They're originally proposed, but I believe that's what it's for. It kind of gives Ames a secondary power.
I remember someone asked me that question. I said, well, I'm going to have to ask something.
Yeah, but for the most part, it's staying by the interstate.
Right.
There was an area down by Huxley that they didn't let them cross. They had to get out into the county a little bit there. But
okay, thank you.
Overall, this past winter, I'd say, is more of an average winter for us. Right now, we're at about 70% of our overtime budget and 80% of our salt sand budget. Some of the overtime had to do with how the storms hit. They were more towards, a lot of them landed during the working day and not quite as much overtime. Plus, we bumped up our comp time banks, the amount of time they're able to put in their comp time balance, so that saved us some money there, too. So, overall, average winter for us. This spring, we had kind of a long, drawn-out thaw period, more than normal. That led to some muddy gravel road conditions. You got that frost underneath and thawing on the top, and that water has nowhere to go. It creates a muddy mess. So we did something a little unusual this year. We brought in motor graders early at like 6 in the morning when things were still frozen to blade those blade those troughs out so it wasn't so rough, because it was bad for a while. But as soon as that thaw goes through the frost, the roads shape up real quick. Another thing we saw more this year than in the past, and you'll see it out there if you haven't received comments already, is you'll see a lot of rock in the ditches. I hate to see it. I can tell you it's not cost effective to dig the rock out. Unfortunately, it's just something we have to deal with. There was a couple weather-related issues that made it worse this year. Going into fall was so dry, and then when the shoulders and the gravel roads froze, there wasn't that moisture to hold everything together, so everything was so loose. And we had a lot of snows on top of thawed ground, so we got into some sod issues too, where our wings ride on top of the shoulders and the grass, and if it's thawed out, they dig in spots. It's just very hard to control, but you'll notice DOT roads, and get into other counties, you'll see the same thing. It's just a difficult thing, and the public sees it, and they get the comments all the time, we can't afford the rock, but then you throw it in the ditch, and I hate it, but it happens. Move on to motor grader repairs. We did have 3 motor graders that come out of this winter with some major repairs. One I already told the board about a while back. That was our actual, we have a spare motor grader that we took out and didn't make it 2 miles down the road, and had a $30,000 repair on that. We did not get that repaired because it was worth $30,000, so right now it's pretty much scrap iron. So that's sitting in our yard. We had 2 more with similar issues. One was a 2005 and one was a 2006 motor grader. Fortunately, the 2006 was full warranty covered, and that was about a $30,000 repair. Got that one back in service already. One they're still working on is a 2005. That was about a $45,000 repair. It was out of warranty on age, but it was in warranty on miles or hours. Motor graders go by hours instead of mileage. So technically there was no warranty, but there's an insurance company that Cat works through, and they fought hard with us to get that covered under warranty. And I believe they're pretty successful. I think about $40,000 are going to cover under warranty. We might have $5,000 to $10,000 out of our pocket, but that was a pretty big deal for Cat to do that for us. So we really appreciate that. But talking about the motor graders and warranty issues got us exploring. Rick, you went over to City of Ames with us. We met with their fleet manager, look at maybe some different purchasing options. And one of them was a buyback situation, and that's something we've actually done in the past. About 10 years ago, we had five of them that we let with a buyback option. That's where some were 5, some were 7 years at that period. They give up front, they give you what they're going to give you back for it in that 5 to 7 years. That worked till we got to the point where we had to buy back that one and then buy a new motor grader in the same year, and the board cut the funding for the motor graders at that point, so that pretty much got us off the buyback cycle, so we kind of lost it at that point.
And let's just be clear, as I understand it, Darren, it's a program that could be beneficial to the county, but it requires consistent funding from the board in order to make it work long term.
Correct, and one of the big benefits is you're full warranty all the time, because you work out where you have a 5 or 7 year warranty, so you got a full warranty coverage on that motor grader at all times.
Don't end up with one sitting in the yard as scrap,
right?
Like we have now.
But we're dealing with Cat right now, talking about what the most optimal buyback period is, and it's 5 years for them, because that's what as far out they can go on their full machine warranties. But we kind of got into a new discussion on possibly a lease option. That's something I wanted to run past the board before we got in too much detail with them, because I don't know if lease is even an option for the county. I know when we bonded, there was some leasing restrictions that we could do, but I'll have to talk to Lisa or the auditor about that if there's any restrictions we have. But the numbers they're giving us back look pretty decent. And what that would do, we'd essentially trade in our whole fleet right up front. That'd give us a lot of equity from the beginning, so the first 5 years, our payments, we wouldn't be spending any more money on motor graders than we would now, and we'd have a brand new fleet up. The next 5 year cycle would bump up a little bit, and that's why I'd have to present the details to you for the long term on how it would bump up. But I want to find out first if leasing was even an option before we get all those numbers.
Yeah, I'd say visit with Jessica and let's just figure out what our options are.
But we're looking into a lot of those options to try to avoid some of these costly repairs in the motor graders, particularly. Maintenance crews, they're transitioning, of course, from the winter to our summer work now. They're finishing up those piling repairs that we were doing in-house on the bridges we had restricted because of poor piling. We finally able to get the concrete poured on those last week. We were waiting for some warmer temperatures, but it took a long time to get there. The day we got them all poured last week, the bridge inspectors gave us a new bridge that was covered with snow, so they couldn't inspect it in their normal cycle. But so we got a new one. We got restricted now on 590th, just south of E29. We're going to have to do the same type of piling repair on that bridge. We also had a contractor in the past couple weeks that did the full piling replacement on two bridges, something we do almost every winter. They finished that up last week, so those two bridges are back in service. Did add two new employees to our secondary road staff due to their retirements. Travis Sargent, who actually worked with us, I think, 3 years as a summer help, so we're very familiar with him. Derek Kruger is the second one. He lives out of Huxley. Touch on some of construction projects. We had a bridge start really early in the season this year, Milford 7, east of Gilbert. Just a couple pictures from that. This was actually about a month ago, driving piling for the abutment here. It had about 85-foot length of piling for that because we did not hit bedrock in this area. So a little longer than we normally have. And then a more recent picture. We're completely out of the water now, which is good going into spring. We got both of the piers poured. Concrete piers are all poured both sides, so the other side looks like a mirror of this side. So we're out of the water. You see a lot of these temporary wood piling. This is a slab bridge. It doesn't have the beams they lay on it. It's a slab, so they have to put in all these temporary
piling to hold up the concrete till it cures, but it is a more cost-effective bridge in the end, though, to build. So it's good we're out of the water, and they plan, it takes a long time to form up that deck, so we plan on a bridge pour sometime in May, and hopefully we'll be back in service in June. E18 asphalt overlay letting, that was let last month. I just wanted to point that out because we had competition this time. Mathey Construction had a project up on Highway 65 for the DOT, so they had a portable plan in the area that created some asphalt competition, which is always good. And so we did get some better prices and probably saved in the neighborhood of $100,000 at least because of that competition, so that is good. Good thing, and it, so the total cost on that was $740,000. Highway 30 work, just wanted to touch on that a little bit. I'm sure you've noticed it by now. They've closed off access from the south getting across 30 on four county roads there. They did want to use the county gravel roads to the south for haul routes, and one road in particular, Sandhill Trail, would get 70,000 tons of concrete and dirt hauled on it. So I worked with the DOT and kind of talked them out of that. Sandhill Trail in particular is a really sandy road, and they would have tore it up. And a big project like that, they would be hauling rain or shine, so it would have tore up our gravel road. So they found another way, fortunately. We avoided that, but still going to get a lot of traffic to the south, so I believe they're still going to put some dust control down at some point in front of the houses at least, try to alleviate some of those issues, but it was getting dusty already last week. But
you can't cross 30 at all now, or even you can't even turn off of it.
Nope, just right in, right out, what they call it on the north side.
Right.
The good thing is they put a short contract time frame to get it completed up to R70, so that's supposed to be open by the end of May. That'll take the pressure off of Sandhill Trail. They can use R70 and get on. Then you'll be able to cross there, so that helps. Had another issue pop up yesterday. I want to pass by the board because you might hear about it. That we have that 590th, that's the Level B road south of Highway 30, dirt road. And it truly is dirt, no rock at all. Contractor has some waste dirt, and they apparently talked with Jensen's out there, and Jensen's asking if we would allow him to put the dirt on this road, and I do not believe we want to head down that route. It's Level B road. One, it's ordinance is passed that we don't spend money on that. We would have to be out there with the motor gear and roller, rolling it down to compact it. But my bigger concern out there, the way everything lies with that road, there's no pipes under the road. It's no secret there's a drainage dispute between the two sides of the road, and what Jensen's really looking for is to build that road up and block the drainage, and I don't want any part of that. things are draining fine now, and so I'm going to tell him we can't do that, but he may be coming to you to ask why, and that's the main reason why. He went out last year, as you might recall, and started filling it himself, and we had to stop him. He thought he owned the road out there, but we told him no, it's still county road, basically for property access at this point. And we blade it once or twice a year.
That's 590th, right?
590th.
South of 30. Does it need to be a county road? Can we just?
Well, we gave them that option last year. I don't believe the property on the other side wants to give it up because it's their property access, and he might be concerned what happened to the drainage at that point too. But I will raise that to Jensen again and maybe try to contact the other property owner to see if they would want it vacated. But I think we touched on that last year, and it did sound like that would happen. Yep. A couple other things we got going on in the short term. We got rock hauling out of Martin Marietta, and that'll be in Indian Creek Township and Nevada Township. Should happen here in the next month. They should get started. And a countywide contract should be starting here in the next week, so you see some new pavement markings. Last item I wanted to address, I kind of pulled this from the five-year program discussion because it might be more of an ongoing discussion for us, is our North Dakota topic we discussed a little bit last week. It's hard to see here, but this is Black Line is North Dakota. This is the stretch we're looking at reconstructing. I've already delayed this stretch a year and moved up the bridge because it can't be done in the same year. We'd be closing off access to the middle portion. So the bridge is moved up to 2014. I pushed this back to 2015. But the guidance I'm going to need from the board at some point is, do we want to proceed with condemnation? Because that's a process. We're going to have to come up with final plans before we can even start right-of-way negotiations, and then the board will have to have a hearing, and they're going to have to say, yes, we're going to approve condemnation for this project. All that has to happen up front. This is kind of what we're dealing with. There is no shoulder. It drops off. It looks like there might be a little there, but there really isn't. It kind of drops off immediately, and you can see that we're starting to lose the pavement on the edge. We only have 33 feet of right-of-way. That's pretty rare for a paved road. What we're looking to do is buy 17 additional feet out here. That'd give us a 50-foot, and that's more standard pavement right-of-way, and move the ditch out and get flatter slopes and have a 6-foot shoulder here. Another angle looking south. You can see the pavement issues. A lot of areas are popping out, so we're having to patch them. I don't know how long they're going to last. The main issues are funding. It's a farm-to-market route, but the only way to use farm-to-market funds to redo this road is to bring it up to current standard, which is 6-foot shoulder and pretty much that 17-foot of additional right-of-way out here. If we just go and continue on trying to patch and maybe put a thin maintenance surface on this somehow, we're going to have to do that with local money. Farm market won't allow that unless you bring it up to current standards. So that's the decision we got to make if we want to do condemnation. If we decide to go down the condemnation route, I'm probably going to bring, this is that curve at the south end, I'm probably going to bring that back into this project if we're going through condemnation anyway. What they would lose some of these trees in the inside corner, but there is a number of them there. Just give you kind of an idea of the accident history out there. Not a lot of accidents on the straightaway portion. It's tough to see, but there's a lot of dots down here. There's 19 total accidents, and this is the years they happen. More recently, there's more accidents. The top of that graph is 5, so there was 5 accidents in 2009, 10, 11. That's the severity of the accidents. Property damage only, most of them, so they're not real severe accidents. No fatals or major injuries, a few minor injuries, but not a lot of accidents on the straightaway, but that's why if we went through condemnation, I'd bring in that curve because that's where all the accidents are happening. Kind of gives you a feel for what we're experiencing. Cameron School by far is our worst accident area up there, so you can kind of compare it to that, but that is the worst spot in the county, and a lot of that is animal.
Have we reached out to any of the property owners regarding the need for a right-of-way without having to go down the condemnation route? And
well, yeah, if just to give you an idea of the process, if we went down the condemnation route, that requires, one, the hearing, and then we would have a public meeting informing everybody what was going to happen out there. I've already went down the path assuming we went condemned, so we've met with some of the property owners, and it's not going to happen without condemnation. I should tell you that right now. And
unfortunate, but yes, I see your point.
And it wouldn't be a land, most time when it goes to condemnation, it's a land valuing issue. This was not a land value, it's just we're not interested, period. And that's more than one property owner's that way. So if we went to condemnation, it'd go through, but it wouldn't be the valuation fight we usually have.
So hypothetically, could we just throw out the option, you know, we could do like some counties, we could just let it turn it back to gravel, you know, and not be paved at all. If that's an option, do they want that?
The unfortunate part is this gets over 1,000 vehicles a day. And
kind of what I figured. Yeah.
Darren, is there not a most everything to the west is Iowa State, is that right?
Correct.
Is there not a possible? Yeah, go back to the other picture of the roadway. Right there. Yeah. So, is it not possible to go 34 feet on one side with willing property owners rather than 17 feet on both sides and just shift the entire bed of the road?
That's possible. It'd be much more costly because we're using this. We're essentially just overlaying this, so we don't have to put as thick of. You'd have to completely tear this out and rebuild it. It'd be much more costly. And I don't think that would go over well with the public either, trying to avoid certain property owners that never went well in the past.
Well, I think, Wayne, I appreciate your point. I mean, I think you make a point like that. We're clearly not taking this road to gravel. It's too heavily used.
Right.
It does not look to me like it is a sufficient road in its current state. We can't use farm-to-market roads unless we bring it up to the current standard. And while I loathe the idea of condemnation, I believe that everything should be on the table for discussion. I would ask that you talk with Jessica because I know I will want to be fully versed on exactly what that process looks like, all the hurdles we're going to encounter before we have that discussion. But I would encourage us not to take it off the table at this point because we have to do something.
Yeah, it's obviously needing a repair, and like you say, your last option is going to be condemnation. But
I think in the short term here, we can continue to do some patching, and if you get time, go out and look at it yourself and see what you think in person driving the road. If widening it's really that necessary, personally, I think it is. But that's a decision you'll have to make because I don't have to make this condemnation decision like you do. So I know I can see that's a tough
one. Well, I asked my 16-year-old daughter not to drive that. I mean, that route can help her from time to time. And, that is one of our few county roads that I'm aware of where it's really easy to put a car in the ditch.
Yeah. No shoulder. None at all.
Right. Yeah. Good.
We'll discuss that more to come. But last thing I had is our National Engineers meeting is in Des Moines in 2 weeks, so that's about a week-long meeting. And so the Iowa County Engineers are very heavily involved in the planning process for that, so I'll be busy in 2 weeks.
Questions for Darren? Darren, thank you very much.
You just let your guys know that we appreciate the job they do. I heard one story got relayed that the motor grader operator was on his route one afternoon and got a compliment from a farmer on the job that he'd done over the winter and hadn't gone 3 miles and got his you-know-what handed to him by the next guy down the road about
how loud the job.
That's part of the job.
Is it?
Thank you.
Absolutely.
I thought it was being supervisor.
Auditor. What are we going to do with the scrap motor grader? Is that you're going to use that for spare parts, or are you going to look to sell it?
Yeah, we're debating because we have a new motor grader in the budget after the next FY, so whether we trade it or take it to the DOT auction, probably get more out of it at the DOT auction talking to the new dealers. They probably won't give us hardly anything for it, so it'd be more of a hassle for them.
Okay.
So it'll probably be a DOT auction thing.
Thanks.
Great. Okay, thank you.
Liaison assignments, committee meeting updates. Wayne?
Just very briefly, I met with Deb Shilroth yesterday. Most of the topic centered around the discussion that the auditors and Lisa had with Boone County, and as we were talking about fiscal policy and so forth as we move into regionalization. I also, then we spent some time discussing the latest action in the legislature with Senate file. The equalization dollars that is being proposed at the present time. And as a result of that discussion, we'll be in the process tomorrow morning. I've asked Bill Peterson, our executive director, to set up a conference call around 8:30 with Linda Hinton, our lobbyist on the mental health, and our Bill Heckroff, along with members of the supervisor, the exec board, and we're going to talk about Senate File 415 and what impact this will have if this moves forward. This is the appropriation discussion. And Deb was kind enough, working through one of our CPCs, to give me some documentation that I forwarded on to the discussion that really shows that this particular plan by the Senate if what goes forward would not be the best option for our regionalization. The 4725 appears to be a much more stable, supportive thing. So what we want to talk about is oftentimes we're asked to take a position, whether we're either far or neutral or what have you. And I just want us to vet, can we speak in one voice on an issue like this, knowing full well that those figures that we submitted may vary depending on the region that we're at. So just wanted to update you that we'll be discussing what's happening there. And it's very likely that there is going to be some movement one way or the other, and hopefully there will be an agreement worked out between the Senate and the House regarding roughly the $29 million dollars that both have agreed needs to be there for right. transition funds.
They're just trying to figure out how to split right. it up. I right. think it's important to note, Wayne, along those lines, that we budgeted based on the House's version, based on
exactly.
the 4728. The Senate bill that is put forward actually reduces the amount we would receive by about $300,000, just over $300,000. So there is a very direct hit to Story County. Now, the good news is it's not quite that bad when you spread it over our whole region. You're
right.
looking at about a $50,000 hit to the region
right.
because a few of our counties would get a little more under the Senate plan. But as far as, you know, what we worry about, we budgeted based on the $1.2 million that comes from the 4728. It would actually be closer to $900,000 if the Senate version passed. So thanks
right.
for the update.
You bet.
Paul, anything? Nothing from me. That brings us to Markley. Lisa, you're going to talk to us about our quarterly financial report.
I am. And I'm going to hold up the real check.
Hey. $752,000.
$700. Going downstairs as soon as I get done here. I have prepared the quarterly financial report. It was included in your packet.
Hmm?
We are at 75% of the year. As you can see from the first page, which is the expenditures, there are four departments right now that are over 75%. My anticipation is that at least two of those are going to come to you with a budget amendment request coming up real soon, okay? I have put out the word for budget amendments. We're going to do that the very last meeting in May, I think. So I want the information to be by the 19th of April so we can have time to discuss it, digest it, publish it, you know, all that good stuff. Overall, we're at 66% of our expenditures for the year. The fund balance status on the second page, we're a little, we've only spent 69% of our general fund. That's good news. We're a little high on our supplemental fund, which that runs high all year long, but it's also had more expenditures this year than anticipated. The insurance and the insurance reserve and the litigations and settlement line items have all seen substantial increases that we didn't budget for, so we're going to have to amend those also. We're only at 41% of our mental health. As you can see, we're at 1.6, and that's before we get these transition funds. The way the transition funds are going to be handled is I set up a separate account or fund, excuse me, separate fund for them. Between Carla, Deb, and myself, we will work through spending appropriate dollars and then transferring the appropriate dollars to the mental health fund.
Yeah, we just need to be able to know down to the penny at a moment's notice where those dollars went.
I was in a conference call, and I'm sure Deb relayed that to you guys, but I was at the conference call last week with the DHS, and they were less than helpful as to how those what restrictions were going to be on those and what the audit requirements were going to be or anything. It was extremely frustrating. So we're going to be very tedious about our documentation.
Absolutely.
We are at 67% in the Rural Services Fund, which is a good thing, and 62% in Secondary Roads Fund. For the revenues, good news, there's 12 departments that are over 75%. Overall, we're at 77.5. I did check the property taxes. They were all 90% at the end of March, so that was good. We only have like 10% left to process. I'm assuming those were just not processed, or the majority of those were just not processed yet by the time I ran the March or end of March reports. So, any questions?
Nope. Again, just thank you for staying on top of this, and particularly I know Deb certainly, and I'm sure I speak for Lucy and everybody that you know, your work in discussing how we need to move forward with our fiscal accountability as we move into the regions. I think having that discussion and getting it off and running beforehand is going to be outstanding. And I think one of the questions still is going to come down is who wants to take on that task as fiscal agent, as you well know that there's a lot more to it when you're talking about a region than it is if you're just talking about one or two counties.
Good news is that at the regional meeting we had on Friday, I got the impression that for the first year anyways, and we don't know how it's going to go forward, but at this point in time, all the bills aren't going to flow through the region, through the fiscal agent.
Right.
Each
county
is going to be responsible for their own bills, and that's where the tedious task will be, is paying all the counties.
Sure.
Right. Good.
But, good. I have been.
We've got 5% left to appropriate?
Yes. That's what I was going to talk to you about also. We have another 5% to appropriate. Direction from the board. Do you want me to go ahead and prepare that? Do you want me to come back to you and say.
Last year. We appropriated 100% to all
elected officials,
all offices, and department we appropriated as needed, what we determined they needed for the rest of the year. Is that accurate?
That's accurate.
Why wouldn't we stick with that?
Worked pretty good last year, didn't it?
Yeah.
So I would say go ahead and get to work on getting that prepared. We should have pretty solid estimates of what departments are going to need. Let's just go ahead and appropriate the full 100% to all our elected officials.
And environmental health, I think, is the only department that the payroll is going to be an issue. And that was, you know, no fault of theirs and no fault of mine, technically, because that's when we started. We did Kristen different, so 50-50. So that's going to need a little payroll, but I've gone through the rest of the departments. I don't see anybody else needing payroll dollars.
Yep.
So any budget amendments you get are going to probably be other things rather than payroll.
Yep. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right.
Welcome very much.
Okay. All right.
Discussion of road maintenance agreement with Iowa State University via DOT for State Street.
Good. And Kathy, welcome.
Kathy,
glad you're here.
Come on up if you'd like.
We appreciate it.
Thanks for coming over. Let's see. For the record, I guess, this conversation came up in the last week or so where State Street is actually a road that is owned by Iowa State. They have an agreement with us. DOT actually, facilitates the agreement with us for maintenance of the road, but the road is in the kind of shape now that we need to get in and do some fairly major reconstruction.
Correct.
Kathy, can you state your full name for the record, please?
Yes, Kathy Brown.
Oh, that's easy.
Let me start with a little history. I've been digging in our file the past couple days. I find some stuff. This isn't a new issue. This has been going on longer than I thought it had. We've been working with Iowa State. The first agreement I can find was 1972, so at least 40 years we've been maintaining the road, doing the routine maintenance on it. And that took place for about 20 years. Then back in 92, I found a letter. Del Jesperson was the county engineer at that time, where he started having some of the concerns about it being too wide, too difficult to maintain. Didn't look like anything really happened at that point. And ISU indicated they kind of wanted it wider in case they were talking about paving in the future. So there was some reasons for it being that wide. And then a few years later, 98, Harold Jensen was the engineer at that point. Again, had some of the same concerns. There's also a lengthy letter from a landowner here concerned about the road was unsafe. It looked terrible. It was coming into Iowa State and imposed a safety hazard. And so at that time, Harold kind of did the same thing we're doing now, tried to work with Iowa State and saying something more had to be done. It's too wide, can't be maintained the way it is. So agreement was actually made up supplemental agreement to essentially regrade the road, narrow it up, bring it up, improve drainage. The board signed it, but I cannot find anything beyond that point. I don't know if Kathy knows, but I don't know if it just dropped at that point, but I don't believe that ever got done looking at the way it does now, unless it got pushed out in that amount of time. But that was in the file, but I don't know the outcome of it. We couldn't find any payments from ISU that paid for our services either in our records. So at this point, I don't believe that ever got done. We currently have the agreement. We renew annually. Right now, we get $2,625 to maintain 1 mile of State Street, and then it's a quarter mile of Zumwalt there. But the picture here kind of shows what's going on. This is at the south end, and it's a little worse here. This is completely filled in. It's got my attention the past 2 years in particular. It got much worse. I'm not quite sure why, but I'm sure it's traffic-related. Last year, I remember some really horrible, just big bumps, not just pothole type stuff. So that's where it started raising my concern liability wise. What if something did happen here? Who's going to be responsible? And a little frustration on our end, on my part, is that if this needs rock, we have to ask for additional funding from Iowa State to do that, and we have to go through the DOT to get permission from Iowa State. And the average turnaround time on getting that rock is about a month at this point. And so when there's an issue out there, we can't address it. I'm hoping that could be fixed or sped up, but that's frustrating on our end. And that's where my liability concerns raise when we know there's a problem, but we can't do anything about it.
What does it cost to put rock on the, you said, it's a mile and a quarter that we're maintaining?
Well, last year, actually, I think it was over $5,000 of rock itself we put on the road, but it's getting
$1,050 or $5,000.
Yeah. And we got approval from Iowa State to do that, but there's so much traffic on it and improper drainage, it just kind of disappears in the mud.
Yeah.
And we're putting it out there every year.
If the road was adequately built, how often should we have to put rock down on it?
Well, that is another concern of mine. If we do this build-up process, this isn't going to completely eliminate our issues. I don't want to make that sound like it'd be the case because it gets so much traffic. It's going to make things better, but it's not going to alleviate all of our concerns. And another thing that came up last year is totally understand why they wanted to do it, but they started putting dust control on that mile with the traffic. It was so dusty out there. We had a dry year. But also what that did is they put the dust control down, so essentially we couldn't maintain it all summer, and the potholes got really bad. But with their investment in the dust control, they didn't want us to go blade it, understandably. And we're kind of on the hook for a bad road condition, but we can't maintain it. That just kind of added to the fold, but I don't know what the solution is there. It just gets so much traffic that bringing the road up, narrowing it up and getting proper drainage is definitely going to help, but when you don't have proper drainage and you dust control, potholes are going to come back so much quicker. When the water, that's what causes a pothole. Water sitting on there and traffic going over is going to create the potholes. But so, let me show it. It doesn't show up on our traffic count maps. It's right here because it's institutional road. We do not have traffic counts on it. My guess would be somewhere around 500, 600 vehicles a day because we've got 220 south. A lot of this traffic comes off R38 and there's a short stretch of gravel here that gets probably even more traffic. But a lot of the traffic is internal to Iowa State, so these numbers you can't really pass through because most of it's internal to, I'd say, 500 to 600 vehicles a day right now. And we met out there last week, and there was a lot of cars going through there in just a half hour we were on the road. So that's kind of where I stood. I didn't feel like we could continue to maintain it unless something more was done to bring it up to where it could be maintainable. It won't fix it, but it'll help. So that's why we met out on the road last week to look at it, and that's where Iowa State's now asking, could we do that work for them? Would we essentially become, you know, the contractor and go in there, probably take us a week or two to do. Same thing was brought up in 98. And at that point, that Harold estimated $20,000 for the work. I'd probably bump that up $25,000 to $30,000 now. Rock's gone up so much, and a lot of that's rock cost. But we'd probably have three motor graders out there, an excavator bringing everything up, and close for a week to 2 weeks, depending on weather. But that's what we'd be looking at if we want to enter in a type of agreement like that. But we'd be pulling our crews from our work to do that road, and that's for something we don't normally do. That's why I wanted to pass it through the board.
Yep.
Get your thoughts about it.
Well, and I'll just give my perspective real quick and then ask for input, Wayne, from you and Paul. Clearly, this is a longstanding agreement with Iowa State that we've been doing. There's really nobody else around equipped to maintain a road like this, like us. But I think it's completely reasonable for the county to say, hey, if you want us to maintain your road, we need it to be maintainable. And so completely reasonable for us to ask for the cost to get it rebuilt. I like the idea of us doing it because then we know it's done the right way. The other thing that hearing you talk, Darren, that I think I'd like to ask for is some kind of expedited process for when you determine that road needs additional rock, where we don't have to go through the 30 to 45 day process to figure out whether we're going to be able to put rock on it. And if there's a way to have, you know, dollars in a fund somewhere that can be freed up pretty quickly, do something like that. But from my perspective, I would love to be able to continue the relationship of doing this with Iowa State, but I think it's reasonable for us to ask to get everything up where it is, in fact, we're able to do what they're asking us to do. So I don't know if you guys see it differently.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds to me like it's beneficial to the university to have us maintain the road. It's the road belongs to Iowa State, and I think Iowa State needs to make a decision what the future of the road is going to be. I can certainly understand Darren's concern that the condition that the road is in now makes it almost impossible for his department to maintain it to a standard that anybody would accept. So I think maybe Iowa State needs to decide what they want to do, and you know, if I'll defer to Darren whether or not he's comfortable with his department doing the actual road, or if he thinks maybe that's something Iowa State needs to look at a contractor to do to get it back into shape and then have us continue to maintain it after that.
We can do it. The only thing I'm just a little bit uncomfortable with is some of the discussions in the past about you liking it wide. If we go in there, narrow it up, and they don't like it, it's their road, but they're essentially turning it over to us to do whatever we want with it. It's a little uncomfortable.
Well, I think
what happens if they don't like
again, and is what you've touched on, is that through negotiation and further discussion, we can sit down with the entities and talk about what is the best way that we can maintain this road to a level that's going to be satisfactory to everybody. And if we cannot reach those type of agreements, then obviously we're not going to be able to fulfill their expectations. I think, you know, we're going to have to rely on reasonable-minded folks coming together to address, you know, the need. Another thing that I do think is so critical in this day and age, and I know this board has really taken a look at it, is that while the road itself is a function of Iowa State and so forth, we are trying to do all we can through a city, county, ISU collaborative working relationship to address the overall needs of the entire area. There are tremendous benefits for the educational opportunities that is connected to the university, which ultimately is a boost to Story County as well. But I do think that we have to clearly have an understanding between the two entities as to what we can do and what cost is going to be associated. And I really appreciated Kathy's call yesterday and the accompanying letter that she submitted to you and recognizing that I think this is an area that perhaps there are some other options that maybe weren't addressed in the past that might be able to be addressed now with having a sit down with them and exploring these possibilities. So I certainly want to encourage us to reach out and do all that we can to assist them if at all possible.
Yep.
But I think we have to be really upfront about what our expectations are and go from there.
Kathy, I'd turn it to you and let you add whatever you want to add.
I guess I would say that I would generally agree with Darren's observations and those kind of things. And I think if we're really focused on how can we pay and the width of the roadway, I think we can work through some of those things. The DOT has, in addition to the annual maintenance contract that is for snow and some grading, has what they call a special services or special maintenance agreement. And what I'd like to suggest is maybe at whatever time frame is appropriate, I don't know if it's a fall discussion or a spring discussion, but we actually outline a project that would give you in a budget that would give you the freedom to just execute what you need to execute. And I don't think we've used that in the past, and I think we probably just haven't talked frequently enough, and we would accept some of that responsibility to be able to be mutually beneficial to the communication. And then with regard to the roadway width, I'd again engage in a little bit more detailed discussion, because I think our concern has been around the area where the rodeo activity is. And I think in the fall, in the past, they've had on-street parking, if you will, on the shoulders. And Darren may have ideas on ways to address that concern that doesn't affect the overall challenges he's faced with.
Sure. Well, it sounds to me like Iowa State would like us to continue the maintenance of the road. We would like to continue the maintenance of the road. We just got to get together and work out the details. And the other one that, Darren, you mentioned kind of in passing, but I'm going to ask that Jessica make herself involved in this, and that is liability if something goes wrong out there. I think it's important that we have that clearly spelled out, where the liability rests and should be part of this entire conversation. Now, it seems to me that if we're going to get in and do this, we'd like to get in there probably when school's out. I would assume that traffic's a little less then, and get going. So time
we
is
talked
up
about
essence.
That when we're out there. We don't really want to open it up this spring because it gets so much traffic that,
right?
You know, a couple rains could shut that down for a couple of weeks easy, and we don't want to shut it. So middle of summer or early fall would be the best time for us to do something like that.
I would ask Darren, you and Jessica, just make yourself available to have conversations, Kathy, with whoever Iowa State deems is appropriate, and let's just work through all these issues and then get something back to us that we can wholeheartedly get behind. And I really appreciate and like the idea of putting together a nice supplemental budget that just addresses some of the concerns.
I think that could easily be done, and my concerns, I think, can be addressed if we just – I just want some buy-in from Iowa State on what they want to see, too. I don't want to just blanket us, go out and do it. That was my concern. I think we can work around that easy.
Sounds good. Anything else for us with this? Kathy, thanks for being here.
You all.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Public forum number two. This is an opportunity for members of the public to comment on items not on this agenda. The board may not take any action on the comments due to open meetings law, but may do so in the future. Anybody wish to address us? Seeing no one moving immediately to the microphone, we'll move on to announcements from the supervisors. Wayne?
Pass.
Paul?
Yeah.
Oh, you got one?
Well, I was going to meet this afternoon at 2:30. We've got some guests, I think some Chileans that's with the Ames Noon Rotary, and former supervisor Halliburton is taking them through the Justice Center at 2:30, and she's asked if I could join them since I'm a Rotarian, and I'm going to go over and have them go through our Justice Center.
Okay, Paul.
Just congratulations to Coach Paterno in Louisville last night. Fantastic.
Patino.
Patino, excuse me.
Yep. Paterno.
Paterno. Big, big game for him, or big week for him, and a great game last night. My son was got home from driver's ed. He had it recorded. No spoiler alert. He had to go upstairs and watch the game in its entirety after he got home from driver's ed.
Pretty good. And then Louisville's playing again tonight in the women's basketball championship, so that could be a good one. Just want to mention security, specifically the Justice Center security. Wayne, you mentioned you're going over there today for a tour. The judges got together and met on Friday. I had communicated with Judge Finn prior to that meeting, and then after that meeting got a call from Judge Steve Owen, who you guys may know, and he and I are going to try to get together and have some conversations as we try to work through where we're headed with security. For me, not only of the Justice Center, but of all of our county buildings. So expect to hear more as we go. Anything additional? If not, I'd take a motion to adjourn.
So move.
Second.
Motion second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are adjourned. Mike, have you met these two guys?